All right, hi everybody, and welcome to Lecture 58 in this Ancient History program of History at Our House for the junior and senior high class. Today, our topic is going to be the Peloponnesian War, as you can see from our title page today, from 431 to 404 BC. Now, this part of Greek history is very challenging. And it's challenging because it involves, I guess you could say, a regression overall. And it's a very unhappy time in history. It involves a regression by Greece to, or return to, the Archaic Plateau. And that is what makes this whole part of history so difficult for me personally to teach, but I think for just about anybody to make sense of and to study, especially now, so far down the line, and to grasp the present-centric importance and reality of it, and to really do it in a way that is life-serving here and now, is very, very challenging. Because the thing that the Greeks did, the Athenians in particular, did that made the world what it is today is very hard to pin down. It's embodied in this cultural period that is called the Athenian Golden Age. And with good reason. People have recognized that this is not my term. I mean, sometimes in History at Our House, I will tell you, for instance, that it's, when I'm using a term, that you're not going to find it anywhere else, like present centrism. That is entirely my innovation. So when you encounter a term like that, or certain terms that I use, if they're only my terms, I'll let you know, because, well, you have to take account for that, right? Because you won't find them anywhere else, and you're going to have to decide if they're useful terms or not for you compared to how you're going to encounter the topic pretty much anywhere else. The Athenian Golden Age, though, is a recognized part of history. Not necessarily present-centrically, but it's a recognized period. You can find it on Wikipedia. And people have recognized that the Greeks, the Athenians in particular, did some things in a kind of concentrated way. They made progress in certain areas that nobody had ever done before. And nobody anywhere else ever did. And it was all in one place, in this one incredible flowering. And as a result, the world is immeasurably superior to what it would be without that flowering. In other words, in some measure, all of us in the world have risen up out of the Archaic Plateau. And it was the Athenians that taught us to do that. It's shocking to think in those terms. It's shocking to realize this truth. The Egyptians would have kept on worshiping pharaohs until 10,000 AD. Who knows what they would never have done anything different. The Mesopotamians were never going to do anything different. Chinese were never going to do anything different. If we study Asian history, you'll see it's nothing but cycles of rise and fall of empires. Indian history, even more pitiful. It was hardly even empires. It's a bunch of separate not even city-states, more like, well, people call them petty principalities. Constantly at war, constantly shifting fortunes. No progress ever. The same thing, I mean, no matter where you look, there's none of the basis for how wonderful modern society is. You can't find it. It doesn't exist anywhere except in one place. It exists in Athens. But only in just the barest beginnings. Just people coming up with some new ideas for the first time ever. And I apologize for the background noise. Nothing I can do about that. It'll go away in a bit. So just a sec, guys. I'm gonna take a minute while those guys blow their equipment horns and all that stuff right next to my window, and then maybe in a minute's time we won't have to listen to that. It's just too much. I can't keep my head straight. Sorry, they totally stole my thunder there. But we'll get back to it in just a sec. You can't hear it? Oh, it's just blaring in my ears. Must be a frequency that doesn't travel through the internet very well. But it's just, and when you listen to it on the recordings, you can definitely hear it in the audio track. It's really super annoying. But it doesn't usually last all that long. I think they might go to a different spot now. Gosh. One day I'll move this operation into an office and I won't have to deal with this kind of stuff. Keen, go ahead.
Are we still working with circuit dates? As far as the dates, like what we have on the title page?
Oh, interesting question. You know, that's a really interesting question. And we're getting to the point where we're not in circa dates anymore. But hold on, let me. That is such an interesting question. But again, the guys with their blowers are just drilling a hole in my brain, so I just can't think straight. All right, so Keen's question is, are we still dealing with circa dates? And the answer is yes and no. The answer is the answer is yes. So I really should put circa. But sometimes we are in a really solid situation. And so really, we're on the cusp here, which is a measure of how we are moving from the archaic plateau to a new level of awareness of human beings. And I'll explain why shortly. Is it because the Greeks are really starting for the first time to record history in a rigorous way. So yeah, we are starting to move away from the circus towards just knowing when things happened, which is pretty amazing. And that's a measure of how this change is going on. Okay, but let me try to go back to my main theme here, even though I've got this noise that's really, I'm sorry, it's making it hard for me to keep my head straight. The point that I'm trying to get to here, despite all the obstacles, is that the present centrically, the Athenian Golden Age, the real significance of it, the real wonder of it, is how these small things, seemingly, these little elements of progress that the Athenians created, whether it's in philosophy, or science, or art, or history, or politics, in any of these particular areas, they barely were these seeds of progress that they sowed. And then humanity had to go through just a tremendous, awful, dark age. But then all those things were rediscovered and re-embraced in what we call the Renaissance, and finally given a chance to really generate some wonderful outcomes. And that's that's what I tried to capture yesterday through, you know, presenting this painting here, The School of Athens by Raphael, right? The School of Athens captures the theme of Raphael's painting, is that Athens taught the world the love of wisdom. This painting is called The School of Athens because it features primarily Athenian philosophers, and it shows you this congregation of learned men who have given this gift of philosophy to the world. And it's featured in the Vatican, which is this city-state where the Pope lives. And it's this modern Christian institution of the Renaissance, and yet it's celebrating ancient Greece. And there's a reason for that, because of that amazing contribution of the Athenians. Athens taught the world to think. Nothing less. And unfortunately, though, our subject today is that these wonderful things that the Athenians invented could not beat back just the momentum of all of the archaic forces at play in their society. They couldn't take off from that and just go and live in another universe. Inventing these wonderful things that they did not allow them to all of a sudden be in a different world than they were. They lived in the world that they lived in, and that those constraints, that reality, sadly, dragged them back down. So, and the reality consists of Sparta and Athens and their archaic disputes. Going back to this, here's a slightly different version of the map that we've been looking at with the two different alliances on it, right? But all of the politics and all of the strife and the arguments and so on between the Greek city-states and the way that they conducted themselves, you can sense that it doesn't have any kind of enlightened quality to it. Right? I mean, isn't it kind of depressing and disappointing that Athens would go and create an empire? Doesn't it feel somehow wrong to you that this city-state that's giving birth to so many of these wonderful values and has been a democracy and it just seems to have so many elements of progress, and then they go and they create an empire? Well, why did they do that? Didn't the things that they were trying to create or give birth to, these new cultural values, couldn't they somehow use those? Or what was it that was keeping them from honoring that? And instead, they ended up going back in that archaic direction. I feel kind of archaic myself right now with the noisemakers. I feel like going and getting archaic, but put up with it. I can't think with these guys sometimes. Ugh, I'm terribly sorry. Usually they're not here on a Wednesday to disrupt my classes. But anyway. So this, like I said, this Athenian Empire is an example of archaism. It's Athens behaving just like Persia. Athens behaving just like Sparta. There's nothing really particularly wonderful about it. I mean, and it's not that it's some kind of horrible corruption or anything. It's understandable in some ways. It's excusable. We can see why they did what they did. We can understand their desperation. We can understand what it must have been like to be a city-state with this massive empire bearing down on you that has attacked you repeatedly and has sacked your city. And this is gotta be just a horrible reality to try to contend with. And it doesn't answer to any enlightened ideas. You can't go to the Persians and offer them, you know, some kind of enlightened argument and they're going to care. No, they're not. They have their completely archaic set of values and there's nothing you can do about it except fight. And so poor Athens is trying to give birth to this wonderful new set of human values, and it's stuck in this archaic context. And it can't get out of it. And sadly, what that does is eventually it just got dragged down to the same level as everybody else. And, well, it's called the Peloponnesian War. We saw last time that Athens and Sparta were starting to bump up against each other now that Persia was gone. We saw that that Thebes, this city-state here that's highlighted in the purple area, which for us is the Spartan part, right? The so-called Sparta and its allies. Thebes was trying to become a democracy like Athens. So that's an example of some positive cultural change. That's an example of Athens kind of projecting its values and other people wanting to copy that and improve their own lives. That's great, but Thebes is inside of the Spartan alliance. How are they going to do it? How are they going to accomplish that? Athens decided that, you know, this was part of an inevitable collision that was going to happen. Pericles was the leader of Athens. He convinced the Athenians that Sparta and Athens were on a collision course and there was nothing you could do. And therefore, Athens should help Thebes. Then maybe by turning Thebes into a democracy, then you tilt the balance of power. And Thebes becomes an ally of Athens and more of the city-states of Greece are democratic and superior and more enlightened in their culture, and maybe Sparta can be stopped, and then maybe Greece can become a beacon of civilization with Athens as the leader, as the rightful leader, because it's the one that has created all these innovations and championed them and been the leader in the war against Persia and so on. It makes sense that Athens should be the leader. And so Pericles led the Athenian army in the Battle of Tanagra, which is where we left off on Monday, I think it was. And Sparta and Athens squared off for the first time. And, well, it was a pretty scary prospect. They had just, you know, basically defeated the Persians and sent them packing. And now what? Greece is going to fight itself, destroy itself. So the Spartans and the Athenians both, despite some of their more warlike leaders, decided that they shouldn't fight. And they made, I can't remember if I introduced you to this the other day, but they made a treaty called the 30 Years' Peace. And I might even have told you the 15 Years' Peace last time if I got it wrong. I had an error in my notes for some, it was a pretty funny mistake. But anyway, they made an arrangement called the 30 Years' Peace. And the deal was very straightforward. Athens and Sparta agreed not to attack each other or their allies for 30 years. I think the date for it is 456, if you need it, because the Battle of Tanagra is circa 457, so Keen, you're asking about circas. We're still at circa.
for the Battle of Tanagra. And the 30 Years Peace, I believe, starts in 456, the year after. So we're still at Circus. But 30 Years Peace, and they agreed not to attack each other or their allies. And yet, if you do the math on this, well, it doesn't work out very well. The Peloponnesian War starts in 431. I don't think we need a Circa anymore there. It starts in 431. So, I don't know. Do the quick math on that for me. That's only 25 years. Oh, okay. So, obviously, the 30 years peace was cut short. So, why did they end up fighting? Well, it had to do with a pretty pitiful type of confrontation that occurred. It wasn't really Athens or Sparta's fault directly. It was more to do with the allies. It had to do with, on the Spartan side, it had to do with their ally Corinth. So you can see in the purple here that, and this is like before, right? You got these different city-states in the purple area. Well, Athens is kind of interfering in their affairs, or they're interfering in Athenian affairs, or what have you. These are the kind of like the buffer city-states that are causing the other two to collide. Corinth was inside of the Spartan alliance, and it was one of the major commercial powers of Greece. And it had a rival, which, strangely, it's not labeled on this particular map because it's slightly off the scope of the map. The rival is over here. I can't annotate it very well. I'm going to switch maps to show you the rival. Okay? So we go to the main map of Greece. I think I'm going to have to bring up my annotations now. Corinth is here. And then its rival is up here. Its rival is called Corcyra. And Corcyra was allied to Athens. And these two city-states, going back for quite a while, had been rivals and had fought wars against each other. And now they were in the two separate alliances. Corinth with Sparta, Corcyra with Athens, and now they're on the opposite sides as part of these big alliances. And, well, their feud continued. It didn't go away just because the more important city-states were doing their thing. The feud between Corinth and Corcyra continued, despite the 30 years peace, and Corinth attacked Corcyra. Do I have a date? I believe it's 432, but I think it's not quite. It's a little bit earlier than that. It's more like 435 or so. Corinth attacked Corcyra, and Corcyra was defended by Athens. So we have a conflict, and we have Athens involved, and we have an ally of Sparta involved. Right? Get the mechanics of it. Corinth has attacked Corcyra, which is defended by Athens. So, has the treaty been broken? The 30 Years' Peace says Athens and Sparta are not to attack each other or their allies. Theo, the letter of the law says what?
It has not strictly been broken because an ally of Sparta attacked an ally of Athens.
Okay, there you go. And you would say that Athens was acting in defense of an ally? And that, strictly speaking, is not an aggression by Athens against an ally of Sparta, but rather the defense of one of its own allies. All right. So anyway, that's the kind of nitpicking type of argument that unfortunately a lot of wars are made up of, right? Because you've got these two sides, and in a way they're kind of itching to go to war. And oftentimes the beginning of war is some kind of petty thing like that. It's some kind of petty dispute where, you know, you've got a treaty. And the treaty was always just kind of, you know, a pretense of some sort, because you really have these two sides and they anticipate fighting each other. It's really more of a Cold War than a peace. And in both city-states, you have people arguing about what to do, and some people want to fight and some people don't. And it's just really messy. And at some point, somebody just waiting for an excuse. That's all. Not really a reason. But, you know the difference between an excuse and a reason. Here, an excuse is a reason for doing something you shouldn't, right? A reason you make up for doing something you know that you shouldn't do or should not have done, rather than a good reason for doing something that you should. It's just a messy situation where Corinth is complaining to Sparta and saying, Athens broke the treaty. Theo and Rosie say they can't hear. I'm sure it's temporary. And so they're complaining to Sparta, Athens broke the treaty, and everybody is, you know, arguing, and Sparta is realizing that its allies are kind of itching for the war and wondering whether or not it could win. So the Spartans went to the oracle at Delphi and asked, and the oracle gave them a cryptic sort of message that hinted that they could win the war as long as they went all in, as people say nowadays. As long as they committed all of their forces to the war, they could defeat Athens. So the Spartans were convinced that they could win, and they declared war, and we get completely wound up in this, what's known as the Peloponnesian War. Now, this war has been studied and learned all out of proportion in more recent history. But there's a good reason why. The reason why is that it's one of the first times in history that a historian actually wrote the history of an episode of human history as it was occurring. This man named Thucydides, an Athenian named Thucydides, was a general in the war, and he was one of the first historians ever. And he wrote the history of the war. The Athenians had the Herodotus, mainly, was responsible for inventing history in the Athenian Golden Age. And Thucydides took up the task and was convinced that history was a valuable subject for human beings to pursue. And so as part of this war, he wrote it down and he interviewed the participants, and he made as detailed a record as you could possibly imagine for something occurring so far back in time. So we know more about the Peloponnesian War than we know about all of human history leading up to it. I don't think that's an exaggeration. In other words, we have this super concentrated record of what happened, down to the details of the connivances and the little rivalries between separate politicians and the what went wrong on expedition X and Y and Z and all kinds of things. We have all the details. And if you want to know what they are, you can read the book, The History of the Peloponnesian War by Thucydides. And so when in up until about 100 years ago, I would say, Western historians considered this to be part of what we call the Western canon. In other words, the most important books ever written. And you couldn't possibly call yourself educated unless you had read this book. And it was because it represents very much the birth of history, the birth of one of these subjects that is at the core of modern civilization. That we aren't stuck on the archaic plateau anymore. One of the reasons why is because we study history. And so people used to be excited about that, and they used to consider the study of Thucydides' history as absolutely crucial in a proper education. And so this used to be studied in great detail. If you read it, though, if you try, I don't think anybody here could succeed. I have never succeeded, by the way. What I mean by that is I have studied bits of this history off and on and tended to use Thucydides' work as a reference work now and then. But the truth of the matter is, it's incredibly tedious. It's incredibly tedious because it's not present-centric. And it could not possibly be. It was present-centric back in 404 BC. Back when you needed to know about this to understand kind of the way that Greek society had evolved or regressed back to an archaic state. It was absolutely crucial to understand how the world had come to be the way that it was. But in 2016, it's no longer present-centric. It's just a story about people that lived 2,000 years ago. And more, right? 2,500 years ago. And all of the vicissitudes of their conflicts with each other that led them to basically commit mass murder and disintegrate their civilization. So it's not a subject that in the past, I've spent a couple lectures telling the details of the history. I've come to realize that it's not worth it. That nobody here needs to know those details. So I'm not going to teach them because here's another aspect of my reasoning for not teaching the details of the war, just teaching the fact of it. But another reason for not teaching the details of the war is because here we have Athens, this birthplace of civilization. And what does the war represent when it comes to Athens? It represents nothing less than a total tragedy. It represents Athens being dragged down back to the archaic plateau. It represents Athens being dragged down back to the level of Sparta. It represents Athens being dragged back down to the level of Persia and Assyria and Egypt and all of those helpless peoples that were stuck on that level and were never going to come off of it. And that is a tragedy. Because the Athenians were starting to rise up from that and they were going to do such wonderful things, but instead, it was all ruined. And that is not what the Athenians stand for in history. Present-centrically, the reason to study Athens is not its failures. The reason to study Athens is not to focus on all of the mistakes or the failings or the problems, the ways in which it was not distinctive or unique or special. The reason to study Athens is the wonderful things about Athens. The special things about Athens. The ones that made our world as great as it can be. So the Athenians fighting each other is fighting the other Greeks and murdering each other is no different than the Assyrians doing that. Is no different than the Egyptians doing that. It's not really something that represents Greece at all. It just represents the depressing reality of the Archaic Plateau. So as far as the details go, the one thing that I think needs to be emphasized out of all of them is the impact that the war had on the democracy of Athens. Now that is a present-centric theme, right? The relationship between democracy and war. Does that sound present-centric to you guys? Does it strike you as kind of resonating with something that you might be aware of? Theo?
Well, the United States is a democracy and we go to war all the time.
Mm-hmm. Okay, right. The relationship between democracy and war in modern times. The relationship between American democracy and war. Right? And this to me is a powerful theme. Because Athenian democracy was young, right? It started in 508 BC. And then they go to war against Persia and they become an empire. So already they're transforming. But it's very interesting. Is democracy inconsistent with imperialism? There's an interesting question. What's your answer to that? Right? Remember when I said, didn't it feel kind of awful or bad that Athens was becoming an empire? Well, let me ask you a question. Are democracy and imperialism incompatible? Anybody want to try that one? It sounds like a big question, doesn't it? Keen?
The things I'm considering in my head are, like, I have no complete answer on this, but what I was thinking was, if you're going to go by the definition of democracy and say that all the people are going to vote, then you would think no. Although it's possible that, as you conquer, those people get to vote, and they vote to, or they are a minority compared to the rest of the
Okay.
They get overruled, even if they voted not to go and conquer more.
All right, stop right there. Good thoughts to have, right? So, but purely on a definitional basis, democracy and imperialism are not incompatible. Right, because the definition of democracy is the majority rules. So if the majority chooses to go to war and conquer another civilization, another society, another city-state, well, that's the choice of the majority. Now, you're suggesting, Keen, that once those other people get incorporated into an empire, that they have some political rights. Well, no, not really. I mean, they are the conquered peoples. And certainly in an archaic democracy like Athens, the premise is that those people have no rights. And primarily they are enslaved and they do not participate in the democracy. So the voting does not change as you're incorporating subject peoples. They do not become citizens. They are conquered peoples. And they have a whole other status. And they're not granted those political rights of yours. That's definitely how Athens treated its subordinate allies and its conquered city-states. They did not have political rights. Well, that's going to be an interesting subject when we look at the Romans as well, and the way that they acted. So anyway, in essence, democracy and imperialism are not incompatible. It depends what the democracy chooses to do. And that's just a collective choice. And the United States has demonstrated that democratically a fair number of times. Now, it's very interesting because what happens typically with democracies and wars is the democracy, a democracy tends to be a pretty, what's the word? It tends to be an inconsistent or, I need a better word than that. It's, the word eludes me. An unstable form of government. Because what it amounts to is there's not really a set leadership, right? There's not really a single faction, for instance, that's in charge. What happens is, by the very nature of it, the factions are constantly shifting and forming up into new groups, and the majority is not any particular thing, right? It's always shifting. And what tends to happen in democracies, and American history is a good concretization of this, is that the majority is constantly shifting depending on how things go. The majority tends to be pretty flighty. It tends to change its mind pretty quickly depending on how things go. And tends to be pretty intolerant of bad outcomes and tends to kind of jump ship pretty easily. And we have lots of examples of that in American history. When wars go well, the majority supports the war. When wars go badly, or rather, the majority supports the government the way that it works here, kind of, you know, the people who are in charge. Then when wars go badly, then the majority turns and tends to flip-flop and go in the other way. So, you know, your thinking, Theo, the modern example is very much part of that pattern. The United States was attacked on 9/11, and then George W. Bush then invaded Afghanistan, and the response was very decisive and strong, and Americans supported the president and reelected him. And then there's Iraq, and then there's that whole story. And it didn't go very well. And when the worse things got, and the more problematic things got, and the more difficult it was, Americans turned. And they decided they wanted change. And then they voted for Barack Obama. That's a very illustrative example of what I'm talking about. That when the war goes well, the people in charge tend to be supported by the majority. When it goes badly, the majority turns. And you can see this, for instance, after World War I. Woodrow Wilson had taken the United States into war, and it was a disaster. It was horrible. Americans hadn't wanted to go into the war, but he convinced them to go, and then it was awful. The very next chance they had to vote, they voted against the Democrats. And Wilson was a Democrat. And they voted for Warren Harding, who promised a return to normalcy. And this is, like I said, this is the pattern in democracies. That democracies, because it's the will of the majority, it's the will of the people, and they're assessing how things are going. And it's non-experts who are just kind of reacting to the way that things are. Tends to be very unstable and bounce from one extreme to another. And so in Greece, the same thing happened. The democracy of Athens had a lot of trouble absorbing the Peloponnesian War because it didn't go well. And in Athens, well, what that did was it revived the conflict of faction between the aristocrats and the commoners. Because democracy was supposed to be this way of overcoming all of those factional problems. But when the people voted to go to war, and when they supported the war, and the war went really badly, democracy took the blame. The aristocrats felt that the basic problem was that the commoners didn't know what they were doing. They couldn't possibly be entrusted with these crucial decisions that have to do with how you run a war. They're too easily tricked, they're too easily convinced by people who are called demagogues that make arguments that are false and too easily convinced to do the wrong thing. And thus, the aristocrats, the best, really, who understood things better than others, felt that they should be in charge. Because otherwise, the democracy is going to ruin Athens. This is a war, and it has to be handled properly. And you can't put the common people in charge. Now, whether or not that's true is, you know, we're not going to sort that out here. But you can see how that something like that would arise as an argument in the case of a war gone bad, right? In a case of a war in which Athens is losing. And it tends to hurt the government. The government takes the blame. And here we're talking about direct majority rule. So it's the whole democracy that takes the blame. And as this Peloponnesian War is going bad, it's going from bad to worse, the Athenian democracy starts to fall apart. So we'll talk about the chapters here, the few different hiccups at the end of the war where the democracy is starting to fall apart. And, well, the main one is that Athens loses the war. Sparta wins. There's no way to dissect all of the military campaigns that led to that outcome. It's way too tedious. But, ultimately, Sparta wins. That's all we need to know. Athens loses, so Sparta's now in charge. What kind of government is Athens going to get now? And how are the people going to handle that, right? Losing a war is demoralizing. It's really hard on people. The blame game starts up, and the arguments and the recriminations fly. And so Athens really suffered greatly because of this war. And of course, because it lost. Had it won, I don't know what would have happened. But there's no way to know. But Athens lost. So when we come back on Monday, we're going to start to chart this disintegration of everything that was good and true about Athens, the destruction of the Athenian Golden Age, in particular, because it has to do with the story of a Greek philosopher named Socrates. And Socrates was alive right at this point. In the aftermath of the war, like I said, a lot of people were directing blame and having very heated arguments in their society, and they were now subject to Sparta, and that was very demoralizing. And that's the kind of context where the majority can be convinced to do all kinds of horrible things. And they did. So it's not going to be pretty, I'm sorry to say. Not going to be pretty. We have to chart the disintegration of ancient Greek culture, of the classical world. And it starts now. We're already going to start to shift towards a whole other kind of society, one that has a few leftover bits of the classical greatness of Athens, but which basically is an archaic society again. And that's almost kind of the worst kind in a way. If you've been archaic the whole time and you never knew any better, then it's just normal. But if you were an archaic society that started to claw your way up to a higher level of civilization and then you drop back down, now that's depressing. And that's what it was like for Athens. So we'll handle all that kind of stuff next week. Sorry, but that's history. It doesn't spare our feelings. We got to look at the bad stuff. There's quite a bit of it. And we have to, if we maintain the full context, right, which is the challenge of present-centrism, is to always keep the whole of the past connected to the present, then at least we can always know that as bad as all the stuff is that we're about to learn, and the downfall of Greece, as bad as that is, the things that those great Greeks did, Thucydides and Aristotle and Plato and Socrates and others like them, the things that those men did survived. And that's the wonder of it, that despite the archaism and despite the barbarism and these people fighting these wars against each other and destroying each other, despite all that, these creations of individual genius, they survived. They were written down. They were transmitted. They were salvaged. They were copied and passed on. This thin thread of a superior kind of human thinking and life survived. And eventually, there were people capable of readopting that and embracing the ideas and creating the Renaissance. And that, at least, is a wonderful thing that really did happen and connected, in essence, to the Greeks. All right, that's our consolation, hopefully. Well, that will do for today, folks. Thank you. Talk to you tomorrow.
Bye.
Bye, Mr. Paul.
Bye-bye.